Welcome to the Sparkwood in 21 podcast. We are a podcast covering Twin Peaks, if you didn't get that already. And this is our third installment of Laura Palmer's Secret Diary. The first two, we actually covered entry by entry, every single thing that she said. No, we didn't do it verbatim. We covered the parts that were worth covering, and we had discussion about it between the two of us. And now it is time for you guys to bring the discussion to us. So here we are in part three, listener feedback.
And before we get started, I would just like to ask those of you who haven't looked at our website, go ahead and check it out, noship.net. And we have a support page, and you can click on the Amazon link there if you are about to do some Amazon shopping, and that will help support our podcast because we'll get a percentage of whatever you spend without you actually paying any extra. All right, let's get to it, unless you have anything else to say.
Should we say who we are?
Oh, by the way, I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
And now we are going to go ahead and get into the feedback. So first thing, I just want to go ahead and read one of the tweets that we had recently on Twitter, and is from Kevin Meyer. Kevin Meyer says, I haven't had a chance to listen to the update, but would you consider covering other Lynch films, especially Lost Highway and MD? What's MD? No, I'm just kidding. I know. Mulholland Drive. But so I thought we could talk about this together on here.
Which David Lynch films would you be the most interested in doing? Because I know I'd be down to do a movie or two of David Lynch easily.
Yeah, I can see why he suggested those two.
I would throw Blue Velvet in there as well.
Okay.
Just as a name in the hat, you know, not necessarily let's do that one for sure. But, and as much as I love the film, I think we should stay away from Dune.
Okay, and those of you who are interested in us covering the films, go ahead and let us know, write to us. How would you like that format? Would you like us to discuss the film in recap form, or just discuss our impressions of it? Or do you want us to do a format where we sync it up and you can have us as commentary as we're watching it? Because we've done that with films before.
We did that with the 13th Warrior for our Vikings podcast, The Wild Hunt. And we just did it recently for the first installment of Evil Dead, the original movie Evil Dead from the 80s, for Deadite Bites. So, you know, we have a little experience doing it in both formats. I don't know which one listeners actually like to listen to more, because we haven't got a whole lot of feedback on that kind of stuff. It's just it's like a little bit of a one-off thing that we do for fun.
I don't know. I might put it in a separate feed depending on how we do it. And that's something we'll discuss further as well. And of course, we'll let you know that we've covered it and let you know where to find it.
But to answer your question, Kevin, we've been kind of beating around the bush with this. Yes, we would definitely be interested in doing one or both of those movies and other movies by David Lynch, because I think doing movies like that is a great way to fill some downtime on, you know, between podcasts, because I find like it's a big peaks and valley situation with the way we do podcasts. We're either just totally, you know, balls to the wall busy with them, or else we have a month where there's nothing on the schedule to do.
Yeah, so it's nice to have some things in our future that we can look forward to and look and be able to give to you guys to listen to. But we do have some other things in mind, and we'll announce those when we do the autobiography of Agent Dale Cooper. Now we're going to get into feedback from Gmail. And so first come, first serve, as we usually do here. And Joel is writing in, and he says, "Hey, Steve and M," he put you first.
Oh, we're bruising some egos here, Joel. Be careful. You're treading in dangerous waters.
He said, as noted last time, these are all responses to your recent podcasts based on topics or points I jotted down while listening. The result was so long that I split it up into different emails. Next up was supposed to be some discussion of Cooper's dream and a theory about Mike and Bob's relationship. However, because you are discussing Coop's biography next time, I've decided to save that installment for later. Instead, I'm going to skip ahead and share my responses to the end of your Fire Walk With Me feedback episode, particularly the questions or interpretations you and different readers had about Leland/Bob. Because you're discussing Laura's diary this week, these seemed more appropriate. Obviously, the Leland Bob stuff has been discussed ad nauseum already, but these were some specific points that came to mind while listening to the podcast, so hopefully they offered additional insight. It also made me think a lot about why defining the gray area of Leland/Bob feels so important versus just accepting it as a straight-up supernatural story and/or a psychological metaphor. That's what the last long bullet point addresses, and hopefully it doesn't seem too redundant after previous episodes. The thoughts seemed original at the time I was writing them, but apologies if I'm repeating myself. Anyway, thanks to both you guys and the other feedbackers for all of the food, Garmenbosia, for thought. For all the writing or discussing I've done on the show and film in this past year, these podcasts have taught me how inexhaustible Twin Peaks is. There is always something new to learn or ponder. Okay, on with the feedback. So first bullet point. Bob coming through the window may be an example of how the supernatural clings to a real event rather than vice versa, like we talked about last time. There is no way Leland is walking outside his house in the middle of the night and climbing up through the bedroom window. It's absurd. Laura herself has trouble climbing down that siding. A secretive middle-aged man is not going to noisily climb up a trellis when it's dark and he can't see and the neighbors can easily be awoken by the noise he is making. Instead, Bob's entry must be what Laura sees while her father is entering or has already entered her room from the hallway. This suggests that Bob is joining Leland only once the assault is already in motion, that he has a parasite feeding off the host rather than motivating it, at least in this case. On the psychological, metaphorical level, of course, it speaks to the victim's desire for the evil to come from outside rather than inside.
That's really interesting. So what you're saying, Joel, if I'm reading you right, is that she sees Bob come in through the window because she's seeing the evil entity that he is, but Leland's actual physical presence is coming in through her bedroom door. That's what I think you're saying. And if that's true, and then they meet in the middle when the physical slash sexual assault actually begins, which is really creepy and scary to think about, actually, to be able to not see the physical part of what's going on, but to see the supernatural element of it. I mean, that's... Eesh.
Yeah, and that puts guilt right back in Leland's lap, too, because he's instigating it, it sounds like.
Yeah, that actually would do that. I mean, I didn't really think about that until you brought it up. I mean, that would put the ball back in his court in a major way, because he's basically meeting him halfway. So there's something of what Leland wants to do. So we're leaning very much towards a Lynchian view of what was going on rather than a Frostian view of what's going on.
Well, I like that you brought this up because I was editing part two this morning and I realized that we hadn't really talked about more in depth about the Into the Woods, what I called a euphemism that Laura was using, and you know, how she brought up how nobody hears her get taken out. And I, you know, had started to think, well, I mean, is that really even happening? Obviously, I mean, because she would describe him grabbing her by the waist and dragging her like a doll. There's no way anybody could do that silently and, or even physically.
Without being seen.
Without being seen or even, I just don't think he could do it anyway, but.
Even if he could complete it, even if he was invisible, somebody would see Laura Palmer's body being dragged down the street towards the woods.
Right. And so was she being drugged also, maybe like he would drug Sarah Palmer with the, you know, the milk? Maybe there was something like that going on. And so in her mind, in her like semi-consciousness, maybe she has a surreal sort of experience and she, that's what she associates it with. And it becomes Into the Woods.
So the woods being a metaphor for a drug haze and also what's happening to her.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's got to be something like that.
Yeah,
because or it puts it more back into the supernatural realm, obviously, because she's being taken in a supernatural way to a supernatural place.
But then we get comic booky because then it's just kind of like everything just happens, poof, you know. One of the things that I liked about Twin Peaks' portrayal of the supernatural is that it was linked to certain realities. It was predicated upon having certain realities. Like you had to go to the Grove of Trees in Glastonbury Grove to get to a certain place. And you had to know what you were doing, kind of like Windham Earl did. It wasn't just something that you could, you know, be like a wizard and just throw your wand out there and all of a sudden all of these things happen. It becomes more believable when there's an actual, system in place, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Also, I do want to point out that it was in her diary that Bobby did climb up to her window. So it is possible to do it.
It's possible, but as Joel points out, a secretive middle-aged man with probably an erection at the time is not going to be able to do that as well as a high school letterman in football. So just to be realistic.
Okay. So next point, Steve wondered if when Leland tells Laura, "I always thought you knew it was me," that was Bob speaking. I've heard a few people ask this, and it honestly always surprises me that this could be the takeaway. That said, I agree with Steve that Lynch is often trying to have it both ways throughout the movie by making Leland seem culpable on his own, but also having Ray Wise clearly play Bob at certain points. And it is worth mentioning that Wise himself sought to depict two separate characters, with the good Leland untainted by Bob. The actor had grown attached to his character during the year and a half of playing him before he was revealed to be the killer. The pilot was shot in February 1989, and Ray Wise has said he was informed about the reveal after the Emmys, which were held in mid-September 1990. He has also said that he was a new father, so the idea of Leland killing his own daughter really disturbed and bothered him. Despite all the ways Lynch edges us to suspect Leland himself in the film, he still usually allows enough ambiguity for Wise's interpretation to hold up of a good Leland overpowered by a totally distinct Bob. However, "I always thought you knew it was me" is perhaps the only moment where Lynch makes it explicit that Leland Palmer knows he has abused his daughter. This must be Leland speaking. Otherwise, why would Lynch immediately follow this with a shot of Bob on the other side of Laura, whispering a different message? Aside from including Leland and Bob in the same shot, one on one side of Laura, one on the other, which would have been visually and dramatically distracting, he couldn't have gone much further to distinguish the two. And the phrasing is important, too. Leland doesn't say, "I always thought it was me." He says, "I always thought you knew it was me." In this moment, as Daniel said in his previous email, Leland reveals his own delusion that what was going on with Laura was their shared secret, which is a very accurate depiction of an abuser's mentality in real life. Combined with Bob's statement right after, "I never knew you knew it was me," the question of the movie becomes, how can it be both Leland and Bob? Rather than, was it Leland or Bob? Somehow we have to figure out how this duality is possible, something we've discussed a lot on previous podcasts.
So we would be assuming that at this point that Leland wants to do what he's doing, and he has the mind and the pathology of an abuser.
Well, look at Laura wanting to do what she was doing.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I can see it. I'm agreeing with this point. I think Joel brings up it's really, really good, because I did not, when I said that, do you think that's Bob saying that, it had not occurred to me to really analyze the scene to the point where I'm thinking about the importance of having Bob on the direct other side of her whispering another message in her ear. How could they be the same at that point? That would be silly.
I guess that's the whole crux of everything, is that Bob needs you to meet him halfway. And if you don't, that's when you die.
Well, this is one of the things that I've been saying the whole time. And I even mentioned this in the Demimon podcast as well, for people who listen to that. There's, as silly as it sounds, if you've ever watched the Oliver Stone film Natural Born Killers, there's a scene where Downey Jr. he's interviewing Mickey, right?
Right.
And he says, "Oh, okay, so it's the theory that everybody meets the devil halfway." And, you know, Mickey doesn't really say anything directly to that, if I remember correctly, but that line always stuck with me. And I think that's the case. I think that we all meet our demons halfway. You know, we kind of venture off into a wrong direction, and then some power kind of goes out of its cave, for, you know, so to speak, and drags us towards that darkness, away from the light and away from the good things that we're supposed to be doing. So we see Laura do that by, you know, the wanton sexuality and the cocaine. And we see Leland doing that by letting his sexual desires, which, as much as it pains me to say, is an attraction to his own daughter, to do that as well. And then Bob kind of comes halfway and pulls you in that direction. Is Bob a real thing, a real entity that resides in the lodge with all of these other crazy entities, with Jürgen Prochnow now, you know, doing the reverse knee slapping and the man from another place, et cetera, et cetera? Or are we looking at him as a metaphor for abuse, as a metaphor for addiction, as a metaphor for the uglier, nastier, darker side of all of our natures? So can he be both things? I think the answer is yes.
Depends on the viewer.
Because we, you know, it really does depend on the viewer. It's in the eye of the beholder to a certain extent. But just in the same sense that we can debate endlessly, and we have really, about whether or not Leland or Bob was fulfilling Frost or Lynch's version of events at any given point in time in the show. We can also debate whether or not Bob is an actual thing that resides in a time and place, or is he a metaphor? Is he part of somebody's or several somebody's imaginations or psychoses or whatever have you? And it really like tickles the imagination, because you could just go in so many different directions with this. But I really think that you do have to have a little bit of something in you and meet it halfway. And apparently this is a family trait in the Palmer household. So there's a darkness within Leland that was able to be exploited by the evilness in Bob. And there was also a darkness in Laura that was able to be exploited by the evilness in Bob.
Yeah, I mean, you could call it a family trait, but you can also, how the common thought is if someone abuses another, that person will grow up and supposedly the tendency is going to be there for them to abuse another as well. Or the likelihood that they'll abuse somebody else will be there as well. So Bob could be a personification of that.
Yeah, that's another thing too. That's a whole different like perspective or aspect of that. And I agree with it completely, because you're right, because she's been abused, setting aside who it was who did the abusing for a second, you know, setting aside that argument, she has been abused. So now she turns around and she's an abuser towards Harold and towards Bobby and towards Donna and towards James.
And Johnny.
But I really do stand by the fact that you do have to meet it halfway, because Donna seems unscathed by all this, because Donna's not trying to meet anything nasty out in the woods halfway.
I think she protected Donna the most, going by what we saw in the film.
She protected Donna a lot, yeah, granted. But at the same time, I think there were certain facets of Donna's personality that precluded anything like that happening.
Okay, so his next point says he starts to say, so Joel's next bullet point. Something else about Bob's statement, "I never knew you knew it was me," seems to contradict the diaries and films' demonstrations that he and Laura had numerous interactions over the years. Some viewers have suggested that Bob didn't know Laura knew he was in her father, but he did know that she already knew about him as a spirit. In other words, he thought his verbal harassment of her was perceived separately from his possession of Leland. If so, this would mean Bob is not limited to one host, but is a more omnipresent evil, seeking multiple hosts and victims, which is actually surprisingly consistent with many details from the series, even though there are other details which may seem to contradict it. According to this reading, Bob's plan was to openly worm his way into her soul while, more surreptitiously, operating on her father as well, an act which he thought was veiled from her. But Laura's extraordinary vision, a gift inherited from her mother, allowed her to see him behind the scenes, so to speak. That's an interesting point. To the point of actually obliterating her father's appearance altogether. Edit. I wrote this before one or both of you mentioned not liking this idea in the Missing Pieces episode. I'm curious, after rereading the diary, have you warmed up to the interpretation of Bob as more omnipresent force, or do you still prefer him to be localized in a particular host or area?
I actually believe that he can be fluid. I think that he can, this isn't possession in the normal, like, Christian doctrine sense, where you have a demon or an invading spirit that occupies a host and then stays there until it's exorcised or that host dies. I don't see Bob like that. I see Bob as somebody who, sometimes it's just a certain level of influence that he might have over somebody. He doesn't necessarily have to use them as a host. And this is something new that I'm just throwing out there, because I've been thinking about what M was reading from Joel's email. But he can, that's why I come up with the term fluid, because I think he can be over here at one point and then he can be over here at another point. Maybe not simultaneously. That might be too hard to pull off. But I think his influence can kind of stick around with people, especially if they're, like we mentioned before, striving to meet him halfway through their thoughts and actions.
I think I was the one who didn't like the omnipresence, but I was thinking of him just being able to exist like an inversion over a city. You know what I mean? But I think he maybe was tired of his host Leland and wanting to have a new host. And he's been grooming Laura this whole time. And maybe that's how he operates. You know, he gets into a new host and then immediately he starts to select who's going to be the next host, and he starts to groom them through abuse. And then he's able to eventually worm his way into that person and grow. To me, that's still kind of localized. It's not, he's not constantly everywhere. Like he's only maybe been able to speak to her once he got somewhat advanced as far as the possession process has progressed.
Yeah, there's got to be rules and limitations to things like this, like we said earlier.
We prefer rules and limitations.
Well, it only makes sense in a way because everything still has to use physics. There's no magic. You know, it's not like he has to progress and he has to get a certain way into her mind. He has to worm her way there and become a presence before he can talk to her and interact with her on that level like he did in the diary. Otherwise, you would just have this nasty Bob spirit who would be like this omnipresent Satan type thing to where he could be doing what he's doing to Laura and possessing Leland and also being an owl harassing somebody who's walking through the woods, you know, just everywhere at all times. The only power that we ascribe to any kind of anything that has that much scope held within it is what we give to our notions of God. So it doesn't seem legit that we'd be able to give that to Bob.
And Joel's next bullet point, here's something important to note. Just before Laura turns to see Bob on her right, she looks down at the mirror beneath her, which is off screen. In fact, the shot is almost from the mirror's perspective. Earlier in the film, we have seen her own reflection morph into Bob. Inside the train car, I think Bob's relationship with Leland is less important than Bob's relationship with Laura, which ties in quite a lot with the diary. Despite being tied up and held hostage, Laura is primarily at war with herself and or the larger evil that wants to possess her. And yes, there was a lot of her looking in the mirror in the diary and not liking what she saw from time to time, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it would coincide with the times where, if I'm not mistaken, that she would decide, tomorrow I'm going to be good kind of thing. And she would, you know, try to start over, like, tomorrow's going to be the Monday of my life, the first day of the month kind of thing, the first day of the new year, and here's my resolution, because she was looking in the mirror.
I need to watch that scene again, because I didn't realize that a lot of that shot is mostly from the mirror's perspective. That's really interesting. All right, so moving on to Joel's next point, the whole Bob question, what he represents, how he operates, his relationship to Leland, is interesting because Twin Peaks and by extension Fire Walk With Me are a cross-section of so many different things. Supernatural genre fare, in which the point is to simply give us a fright. Murder mystery procedural, in which we are attempting to uncover some sort of truth. Always on the story level, but usually on some more symbiotic level as well. Avant-garde surrealism, in which we are treading on other realms of consciousness by skewing the appearance of the real world, and metaphorical psychodrama with the purpose of revealing a character's inner state through exaggerated experiences which represent how an experience feels from the inside rather than how it looks from the outside. The different modes of storytelling sometimes complement each other, but sometimes they break down and become dueling frameworks through which to view what's on screen. I think Lynch himself is a wild card, mediating between these frameworks, the key to deciphering their tangle. While he hates to deal with explicit meaning, it always seems incredibly important to him that his work, at least his feature films, resonate on a very deep level. So whatever creative decisions he makes must be viewed in that light. What does this image or action tell us, consciously or subconsciously? This is the trouble for me with Bob. He is a fantastic concept at first sight, and Lynch uses him brilliantly and to terrifying effect on the show. He's easily one of my favorite characters. For a long time, he serves as shadow haunting our vision, telling us that something is not quite right in the world we are seeing. Then, slowly, the shadow starts to conceal as much as it reveals. There are so many reasons for this, which have been discussed in previous emails, the other writer's very literal interpretation of demonic possession, Mark Frost's desire to move on from Laura's mystery, David Lynch's desire to leave everything open for interpretation. But by the time we get to Fire Walk With Me, Bob has taken on so many confusing roles. He is the embodiment of all evil, an extra-dimensional boogeyman, a metaphorical image of incest, a projection of Laura's own dark side, and a symbol for the idea that we want evil to be an immediately identifiable outside force, or maybe for the idea that evil is an immediately identifiable outside force. We've talked about this being a Lynch-Frost divide, but Frost has seemed pretty open to interpretations of Bob as a projection of Leland, so I wonder if this isn't more of a divide within Lynch himself. Looking at Fire Walk With Me in a light of Lynch's previous work with its starkly drawn villains like Frank Booth, Bobby Peru, the Harkonnens, or the assorted bad guys of the Elephant Man, Bob fits in with their ilk. He is grotesque, grubby, charismatic in his evil, but unmistakably a bad guy. Tying him to the likable Leland to him is a new wrinkle, but the familiar idea is mostly to do with the evil preying on goodness and exploiting its weakness, corrupting the individual without truly making him responsible. When a glowering, clearly Bob-controlled Leland hovers in the window or marches his victims through the woods or broods in his bedroom, the impression is of a malevolent puppeteer pulling the strings of a helpless victim. My problem with this is that it doesn't feel truthful to me. That didn't bother me on the series, but the film is otherwise so honest about Laura's experience that it demands equal honesty about Leland's experience. Abusers are often charming, personable, good father or husbands or mothers or wives to all outside appearances. It isn't that some evil has taken them over, but that the evil arises from the same place as the good, and recognizing this prevents us from turning a blind eye when evil couldn't possibly be present based on surface appearances. In reality, Leland calling his daughter princess and holding her hand is entirely consistent with him manipulating and yelling at her and going into her room at night. And I hate the lie, which the film occasionally flirts with perpetuating, that these two figures couldn't possibly be the same person. This was my trouble with the film the very first time I watched it. And yet, looking at Fire Walk With Me in light of Lynch's later work, with its entirely ambiguous, more metaphysical forces of evil like the Mystery Man, or the creature behind the diner, or the Phantom, and its deeply flawed, denying protagonists like Diane Selwyn and Fred Madison, a very different picture emerges. Leland, and to a certain extent Laura, fits in with these characters who feel themselves the helpless victims of larger forces, yet who do have an agency and who, most importantly, make very real human decisions that lead them into or out of their hellish experiences. The goody two-shoes Betty and dumb kid Pete are flimsy facades to conceal the troubling knowledge and guilt that lies beneath, just as Leland's cheerful father persona is just the tip of his iceberg. And that brings us back to his original bullet point, Leland have an agency meeting Bob halfway.
Joel brings up a lot of really good points and states them in a really eloquent fashion. That's a really well done letter. Thank you. I would tend to agree with almost all of that. And the gist of what I got out of it and what resonates the most with me about what Joel was saying is the fact that Lynch as a creator has this tendency to what we're doing right now with his work is probably something that he despises. I think the way that this is done by the fans for the fans, because I think that Lynch himself would hate it to know that people are trying to dissect what he did and what he said and what he wrote down on paper and what got eventually shot onto film into these cordoned off little areas of truth to where we can say this is this and that is that and that's the end of it and there's a wall between them. He likes the permeability. Joel was talking about how we create all of these, or we have created for us all of these different lenses in which to view the Laura Palmer / Bob / Leland phenomenon, but sometimes they contradict each other. Like you can't see it at the same time. It's like trying to look at the same story or experience the same story in a novel, a comic book, and a movie, and then walk away going, okay, well, which one is the real one? What do I really believe? Because there was elements put in and left out of each one. So going back to the idea that David Lynch would hate that, I think what he would rather have us do is watch this and then just kind of come away with it with a feeling, with some sort of something that's tickling the back of our minds going, you know, why do I think that? Why do I feel this? And to have it, like he said, still resonate with us on a very deep level, but not be so explicit about actually what it is. But we're not here to do that. And podcasters and hardcore fans are the exact opposite of that. Yeah. We want to know. We want to get down to the brass tacks, the nitty gritty, and figure it the fuck out. And
or just to discuss it, because that's pleasurable in itself. Like, I don't necessarily have to get to the truth. it'd be nice to get there, but...
Well, I mean, the journey is the destination in this case. I agree. Yeah. But, I mean, if we weren't trying to get there, we would never have these conversations in the first place. So, I don't know. I stand by it. I think that... He doesn't like what we're doing, but we do it because we're the actual fans, and it's a paradox. It's weird, but you know, we're the ones that are going to make Twin Peaks 2016 or 17 a success. So there.
So Joel goes on to say, when Leland stumbles to come up with a cover story in the car with Laura, when he cleverly and viciously mocks her at the dinner table, when he trembles in the train car and says, almost poignantly, that he thought Laura knew, we are seeing a completely human, deeply nuanced depiction of the ways evil manifests itself in a person who wants to think they are good. This may be one reason I tend to prefer Lynch's later films as much as I admire the early ones. Rich, complex characterizations like this hit on the much deeper level. This Leland is unsuccessfully fleeing part of his nature just as surely as Fred zooming down the lost highway or Diane screaming as the old folks chase her through her home. I find this insight far more profound, affecting, and honestly helpful in going through life. And when I finish these films, I'm left shaken, but extremely grateful for the experience. Yeah, just basically what I agree with you on that. And that's, I think, what Steve was saying earlier about it does resonate emotionally, something that tickles at the back of your mind. So I do think David Lynch succeeds with his MO. So Fire Walk With Me ultimately lies right at the center of these two visions of evil, and it has a foot in both worlds. I tend to think it edges ever so slightly more towards the later view, but that may be just me focusing on what I prefer to focus on. What's certain is that Lynch himself was following his instincts, and he always does, and at this moment in this film, they were pulling him in two directions at once. Does this make for a flawed film? Maybe. But it also makes for the most fascinating, most revealing his work of his career. Who's to say where Lynch stands now? It's been 10 years since Inland Empire. In 2016, will we get a vision of evil similar to the early works or the later ones? Is Leland's statement in the Between Two Worlds video, I did not do these things, to be received literally as an exculpation or as another example of Leland's inability to take responsibility? What seems unlikely to me is that we will get something as balanced and or divided as Fire Walk With Me, given the very unique filming and circumstances of that movie. I think one way or another, Lynch has a much firmer grasp of what he wants to convey today. I'm not yet sure if I'm excited or unnerved by that possibility. I don't think he would be doing this if he didn't feel he had a firm grasp.
I totally agree with what you're saying. I think he's probably shied away from projects that people have presented him in the past because he didn't feel like he could execute that as well as he would want the fans of that material to, you know, to have seen, especially after his experience with Dune. So even though I think if he had done it, he would have made a really good movie that people would have enjoyed. That's all I can really say. That's the best way that I can put that.
And he's had all these years to mull it over. I'm not really nervous about it, actually, which is surprising because, you know, there's been other things that have been brought back, things that have gone from book to television or film that I've been apprehensive about. This one, I'm not so much because it's in the same hands it was in before. And I feel like these hands are more experienced. And like I said, they've had all this time to think about it. And
they're also not doing it to fulfill a contract. They're not doing it to get some quick and easy cash.
Yeah.
They're doing it because of the love of the material. They're doing it because they actually have something more to add to the mythos of Twin Peaks. I'll say this. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I have more faith that Lynch is going to bring home the goods with the new Twin Peaks series. I have more faith in that than I have that Disney is going to give us a really great ace in the hole Star Wars movie. And I hope that my expectations on both fronts are just blown away. That would be awesome. You know, that would be totally awesome. But if I had to pick between the two, I would say that for Twin Peaks fans, it's going to be a better experience seeing this new Twin Peaks than it is for Star Wars fans seeing this new Disney version of Star Wars. And not that I'm down on it. It's just that's how much faith I have that Lynch is going to do the right thing. All right. Thank you, Joel. That was awesome,
Joel.
As usual.
Wouldn't expect any less from you.
Our next one up is feedback for The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer by Jennifer Lynch. And this is from Daniel. Feels weird. Feels like we haven't read feedback from these guys in a long time.
It's because we haven't.
I guess we haven't. Daniel says, "Hey, Em and Steve, I did not discover The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer until after I had already watched the series and the film. Because I feel such a strong affection for and connection to the character of Laura Palmer, I really appreciate the deep dive into her character that the diary provides. The entries range from the tragic to disturbing to heartwarming to racy. As it was first published in the months between the break from season 1 to season 2, if you look at old Usenet posts on the alt.tv.twinpeaks boards, This material caused a surprising number of readers to suspect that Laura was sexually abused by her father Leland, and some were even already convinced by the book that Leland himself was his own daughter's killer. According to Jennifer Lynch, during the writing process, she became one of the few, quote, breathing mammals to be entrusted with the secret of who killed Laura Palmer, by Lynch and Frost. And Lynch was quoted as saying about the book that the careful reader will know the clues and who the killer is. Interestingly, Jennifer recently revealed that she wrote the first draft in 9 days, but when she put it on a floppy disk and flew to New York, all her work was somehow lost from the disks. This forced her to rewrite it from scratch a second time, taking only 3 days. Who knows what might have been lost?
She wrote that in 3 days?
That's fucking crazy. I mean, it always takes less time to read a book than it does to write it, obviously, but I mean, I read this in basically one long afternoon while we were preparing for it because I wanted it to be fresh in my mind when we podcasted on it and everything. But to do that in 3 days and to have all of the proofreading and I guess the proofreading and editing took longer, but just the initial drafts, that's crazy. So what I like about what Daniel's saying here is I had no idea about this old Usenet posts. I guess this is like the nascent period of the internet when people were doing message boards and things like that, which I didn't really use the internet until it became a little bit more widespread, so I was not an early adopter.
I bet they were using those poems as their
basis
for that theory. And he's hardly mentioned at all in the otherwise.
Yeah,
he's got very few moments, but so Sarah has few moments too. But
so you know, all these people who were doing that when they got to the episode where it's revealed that Leland Palmer is the killer, they were just like, "I fucking told you," to all their friends, and they're like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." Daniel goes on to say, seeing a first-person view of Laura's inner torments and her tragic downward spiral are both eye-opening and relatable, like the struggle between the facade of her smiling framed portrait and the fucked-up girl trying to keep her head above the proverbial water through the years of rape, drug abuse, supernatural and psychological oppression and exploitation by the seedier elements of her weird town. The darkness underlying the work is apparent from almost the first entry where, after describing the happiness of a great birthday, we find the highly suggestive and disturbing sudden postscript devoid of context. P.S. I hope Bob doesn't come tonight. Mm-hmm. What is really sad when you think about it is how Laura tries everything she can possibly think of to defeat Bob, but nothing short of taking the ring and the sacrifice of her own death actually works. She tries to be good. She tries to be bad. So she does drugs. She gets off drugs, etc. All to no avail. Yeah, it makes me think back to that line that the thing that frustrates her the most is that nothing I can do can defeat him. But I almost wonder if that's what he wanted her to think, and he got her into that position. And then once she convinced herself, all the work was done for him.
Yeah, because we discussed this on part two about whether she had a chance or not, if there was something she could have done. And you were being more optimist than I was about it.
I guess that's just optimistic
about it than I was.
Yeah, I was being optimist prime about it.
Yes.
One of the characters who is portrayed I find hard to reconcile with that of the show is Leo Johnson, who we learn liked to play games with Laura in a chair in the woods where masked figures apparently held sex parties, groping and role-playing with her. Who are all these masked people? Is there some kind of orgy cult that we never heard about in the show?
I wondered the same thing.
Yeah, I think we all wondered that. It's just like, all right, because we made jokes about it saying Pete Martell's in there and, you know, Hawk and whoever else. It's just like, come on, where are these people coming from? Where do they live? Do they all come across the border to this one particular spot, you know, where it's just really hip to have an orgy? In any case, the mystical nature of the forest is highlighted quite a bit throughout the diary. By the age of 16, she's had sex with literally 40 people, according to the list of initials she writes on February 1st, 1988. Of course, there is B listed first, probably for Bob, BB for Bobby Briggs, LJ for Leo Johnson, or Lawrence Jacoby, but probably not. No, that's a good point.
It's Leo Johnson.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Leo Johnson too, just because I don't want to imagine the other one. RP for Renette Pulaski, JH for James Hurley, though he hasn't been introduced yet in the diary, and so disturbingly could be Johnny Horn, as well as another JH, probably for Jerry Horn. Ah, I didn't think of that.
Oh, but wasn't the JH next to Mysterious Unknowns? So Jerry Horn was at that orgy, maybe. Or is there another JH in the list?
Let me
grab it real quick.
That would be...
I'm glad we're getting some speculation on these initials. Let's see. Oh, there is two JHs.
Aha. Uh-huh. So...
Okay.
Additionally, I think one of the DMJs could be Dwayne Milford Jr., son of Mayor Milford, who runs the Twin Peaks Gazette. CDM could be Catherine Martell if her middle name started with a D.
Oh, God.
Notably missing, which we talked about, is Jacques Renault, Benjamin Horn, Josie Packard, and Harold Smith, because they were all from her next year, presumably. Mm-hmm. However, Jennifer Lynch also threw in a weird Easter egg here that is kind of disturbing when you think about it, in that she also lists DL, MF, DD, HP, BE, and even CJL, which is beyond coincidental and undoubtedly her way of saying that her own father David Lynch, writer Mark Frost, director Duane Dunham, writer Harley Payton, writer Bob Engels, and even Jennifer Chambers Lynch herself all fucked Laura Palmer.
And I think the LD is Laura Dern, because that was the first person I thought of. Is there a KM?
That's awesome. Oh, that is awesome. And I remember reading somewhere, though this is unsourced, that there might have been some kind of fan contest or something where Jennifer wrote down a few names and fans said, there, you fucked Laura Palmer. But that's all I got. Could you do any better? No, we couldn't. You probably already heard our speculation on what we thought the initials were, and I think it was limited to why was there no Jacques Renault? And, you know, who hadn't been on the list at this point kind of thing.
I didn't invest a lot of brain power into this one.
Yeah, but it is pretty cool Easter egg kind of thing to have the names of all these people on there. But it's amazing when you think about it. She's 16 years old and she slept with 40 people. I'm not going to tell everybody how many people I've slept with, but it is far, far, far under the 40-person mark. And I'm 40 myself. So Laura Palmer got around. The conversation Laura writes out between her and Bob when she is, I guess, channeling him inside her are some of the most interesting parts of the book for me. The way he manipulates her into blaming herself for the abuse because she is somehow bad, or some of the more graphic scenes of sexual abuse, like when he tells Laura to hold the sticky and lick it clean while she recites poetry, are deeply disturbing to imagine a little girl being put through.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. Yes. Agreed. 100%. And it's cool that you like them. I mean, I don't think those parts are bad or anything like that. I stick by my assertion that it takes Bob out of the realm of the scary guy that we know from the show and from Fire Walk With Me and overexposes him just a little bit. And that's a small criticism, but it's there. So I'm going to say it.
It's inevitable. You're going to get a lot more Bob when you're reading something through.
Yeah, I agree that it's a necessary evil. I'm just commenting on the byproduct of it, I suppose. Some parts do strain credulity just a bit, such as 12-year-old Laura's advanced writing, spelling, and grammar skills, or how Laura is supposed to be carrying this diary around with her everywhere, somehow taking the time to write out long accounts of situations like the drug deal gone bad with Bobby, or the time she was kidnapped and almost gang-raped. Like, she's like writing it as she's running through the woods away from these shitty situations.
Well, some of those were after the fact. You know, I think she was writing in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I understand that, yeah, that some of it was done definitely later on when she had a little bit of perspective and she could have some clarity. But sometimes there are a few passages. I don't know if they deal directly with the two incidents that he mentioned directly, but that she says, okay, well, you know, she's writing down something and then she says, hold on, I have to wait until somebody goes away, or I have to wait until I go down and do the dishes. And then she goes back up and finishes them. And so it's this like weird interruption. Like, she was actually writing this down as the action was happening.
And she does, I know, bring it with her when she goes to score her first cocaine deal with Leo.
Which is crazy when you think about it, because this is somebody who decided not to write down the eventual hiding place of the new diary because she didn't want anybody to know where it is, which is kind of weird, because if they were reading it in the first place, they would know where it's hidden because they found it, unless she dropped it, I guess. I guess it's just a double safe thing. More disappointing, however, is how the closer the diary gets to the end, the more important characters from the show end up getting only one or a couple of pages to explain her connections with them and their appearance in her life. Like Harold Smith, who we learn she definitely raped, Dr. Jacoby, Josie Packard, whose English lessons turned into seduction and sex games, and even James Hurley, the boy she screamed that she loved. I was hoping that the diary would give more background of Laura's activities with these characters, or that we would learn more about the details of her time at One-Eyed Jack's with Madame Blackie Rose. Other details are a bit weirder, however, such as the fact that Laura was apparently pregnant at one point and got an abortion in secret. Would that have been Leland's spawn? Oh, that's a good question. I didn't even think about that.
It's definitely a possibility.
It's definitely a possibility.
1 out of 40.
Yeah.
Chance.
He has a 1 out of 40 chance. That didn't actually cross my mind. I was thinking about everybody else. I was thinking about Leo, Bobby, random truckers, people at the orgies, Jacques, for Christ's sake. But it didn't. Yeah. Wow. I don't even know if that bears closer contemplation.
Is there a TGW? Maybe she put like the Great Went instead of Jacques Renault.
Oh, that's possible. Yeah. You gonna check real quick?
Yeah. Nope.
Is there blank as a fart? That's too many. Daniel goes on to say, but altogether, I think The Secret Diary is a powerful companion piece to the show and the film, and a good way to dive inside the troubled life and mind of its central character, Laura Palmer. During the filming of Fire Walk With Me, Cheryl Lee kept the diary with her and read it to help her better understand and portray her character. From reviews I've seen, it also serves as a believable account of a teenage girl going through the confusion of adolescence and thinking no one else ever had the kind of thoughts she does. Owls are sometimes big. Children are sometimes prey. Watch the window, Daniel. Awesome. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Creepy sign off, Daniel.
Yeah. I like how he says, it's a really good way to put this. He says, from reviews I've seen, it also serves as a believable account of a teenage girl going through, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of just saying that outright, he says, well, from the reviews I've seen, because he's not a teenage girl, and he probably isn't in the habit of reading teenage girls' diaries. You know, so it kind of makes you think when guys talk about this book and they say, oh, it's a totally believable account of this or that. It's
right.
Like, that needs to be prefaced, or else you sound like a fraud or a creep. So I'm glad Daniel, who is neither, had prefaced it like that, because I think it's important, you know, to say that. But I didn't know. Did you know that Cheryl Lee kept a copy of the diary?
I think
with
I
her?
Did, but I forgot it. I think I've read that somewhere.
Yeah, it seems kind of familiar around the edges of my mind somewhere, mm-hmm. but I don't remember. That's awesome, though. I mean, that's a...
And in reading the diary, I felt that connection with the film, too. So it's... It permeated.
Yeah, it definitely did its job. I mean, we wouldn't be doing a podcast on it if it sucked and it was just some sort of throwaway piece of, you know, consumer. So many movies have so much merchandise attached to them that aren't even worth bothering with. And this is obviously not one of them.
So next up, the subject is, ignore my first email. This is the real feedback of John Bernardi, because he had sent us one prior to this. And okay, so he says, I was reading the feedback I sent you for the episode and decided it was unfinished first draft after all. Please burn it and read this instead. This is the final draft here, and I promise no more changes. Hi, Em and Steve. That's right. That's the order I want to hear.
Joel, you messed it up. I'm telling you, it's always got to be Em and Steve. And when Paul's around, it's Em, Steve, and Paul. That's just how
it's
it works.
Not always true. I'm just having fun with it. Whatever. Okay. Going monthly with your podcast is both smart and heartache inspiring. As a guy who likes to contribute, I say thank you for giving us the time to put together our thoughts too. As a listener, though, I wish I could still hear you weekly. I think the quality to episode level might tank, but I'd listen to you making raspberry sounds for a few minutes and then saying, hi, this is Steve and this is Em, and we still like Twin Peaks. There you guys go. That was the source of our inspiration for
inside this. Joke explained.
Yes. He says, I've got a big email and I'm not sure where to put this, so I'll just say it up front. I know there's a debate whether Bob is an actual entity or some subconscious creation to mask incomprehensible truth, and I come in firmly on the side that he's completely real. Ray Wise is on my side, believing that Leland was completely controlled by Bob, so I feel fine not budging on the issue. And even David Lynch seems to be with me based on all the lodge denizens that appear in the movie. While working on this feedback, I heard Joel's interview on Twin Peaks Unwrapped, which was awesome as I've come to expect. I have a hard time believing he'd only seen the series in 2010, as far down the rabbit hole as he's gotten. Great job as always, synthesizing the information and staying spoiler-free. How difficult a job was that? I also have to bring up how in the Fire Walk With Me feedback episode, Joel summarized the reaction of a Twin Peaks fan to the movie was pretty spot on and explains exactly the issue I have with it. There was too much Twin Peaks that seemed almost adversarially divergent from the series for the ardent fan to process in a peaceful manner. I love Agent Desmond and Sam. I find that the Teresa Banks stuff interesting overall, but the specific Lodge mythology they played with was not Twin Peaks to me, and I still feel fine waiting to see what Frost decides to leave in from the movie before I believe it to be anything more than what feels like extremely cool and wouldn't it be fun if style of fan fiction. In the fanfiction comment, I'm looking specifically at the Blue Rose case and Lil. Throwing in the color blue alone seemed like a slap in the face since I think it was Uli Edel who said he wanted to include a blue briefcase in his episode, but Lynch came back hard with a no color blue allowed clause. Yet here it is in the movie seeming to say, look at this. The show would have never let this happen. Maybe because David Lynch had plans for that color blue.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So that's what I'm thinking, because I think I read that and thought that before. So John goes on to say, and while I'm at it, why so many things outside the city limits? That right there is half of the problem. Pittsburgh is right on the edge, but Buenos Aires? That show stays in town and the magic stays with the show. Leave the town and you get Evelyn Marsh and her weird brother lover Malcolm. I forgot about them. And that's all I should need to say about that.
Yes, that's all you do need to say about that.
Okay. John goes on to say, I feel what Lynch was trying to do with the movie was consolidate the one true story of Twin Peaks as he knew it into a single movie, much like movies based on an anime can do. Razivan comes to mind. I hope I said that right. 26 half-hour episodes are retold over the period of a two-hour movie, so the slow burn mystery of the love story that I loved so much in the show was put out there right in front of the viewer as common knowledge. So there's no onion to unpeel in the Razivan movie, which charged the whole vibe of the show, regardless of how many plot similarities there are otherwise in the retelling. It was still good, but it's like changing a pear into a grape. Still good, but hard to explain. I didn't understand any of that because I have not seen Razivan. That's probably pronounced like something else, but
I get the concept, though, what John's talking about. It's when you have a story that's told in a certain way, and then you get a retelling of that, which is almost done, even though it's still on screen or perhaps in a book or done in a comic or whatever have you. It's almost a different format completely because of the way that they
the medium.
Yeah, it's not just the medium, it's the usage of it. So if you go to it could still be on television, but if you have half hour increments and then you take that whole story and you condense it or consolidate it rather into a 2 hour long movie and it shows you everything and kind of cuts away some of the filler perhaps, you get all of the nutrients, but it's a different delivery system altogether.
Yeah, it's like the Peacekeeper Wars for Farscape. It had a...
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's a great example. It's a really great example. If anybody was ever a fan of Farscape, when you watched the Peacekeeper Wars, you knew that this was... You could actually see some of the little mini plots that were going on, and you say, okay, that was an episode or two. That would have been an episode or two. You know, so you get the gist of what it is, but it would have been so much better to have it as a whole nother season to end out the Farscape saga rather than this, you know, 2.5 hour long slog of a movie.
So John goes on to say, based on Fire Walk With Me itself, Steve's fellow victim theory, and Joel's idea that the scorched engine oil became a powerful concept only after Laura experienced that scene in the car with Leland, I now believe in my own head canon that Lynch converted Twin Peaks into a circular story with only one main character and one where all the Lodge mythology begins and ends with Laura Palmer. Had Fire Walk With Me not tried to be so many different movies, had it not intentionally tried to polarize, had it not tried to rewrite the show itself, had it just stuck with all the amazing scenes and off-the-charts acting involving Laura and her tragic and beautiful redemption, Fire Walk With Me could have been something to be embraced immediately. Instead of people being confused about how it was and wasn't, really whether or not it was, a direct follow-up to the TV series, it would have been what it should have been in the first place, a direct sequel and bookend to the diary, and an unquestionably read, way less controversially, vital piece of Twin Peaks, which, leaving out the first part of the movie, it absolutely is. And from this perspective, putting on the blinders for anything not directly related to Laura's story and incorporating your podcast analysis, I adore the movie.
Well, I'm glad we could help. Because I didn't realize until we started getting feedback on Fire Walk With Me that people were so polarized by it, and that there was a strain of thought in fandom that kind of puts forth the idea that Lynch was being purposely antagonistic to fans of the show in a certain way. I mean, I guess I can see that now, having covered everything and at the beginning when you see the axe go into the television and stuff like that. Some people could actually probably be forgiven for believing that David Lynch wants to kind of take away Twin Peaks from the people who were complacent to just only have, if they were team TV show, to kind of pull it out of their realm with Fire Walk With Me and with the diary and its contents and all of the stuff that had to do with Bob and Laura, and say, this is the real Twin Peaks. This isn't your, double R pie and coffee and, mm-hmm. and, funny sit on the porch type characters who are going to make you laugh. This is the real nitty gritty, dirty part of it that I really wanted to tell, and screw you.
And John goes on to say, and I adore the book too. It's a tough one, especially all of Laura's entries as a 15-year-old, but this book is worth it. And I'm saying it's worth it for fans of Twin Peaks, not just fans of the series or of the movie. I'm saying both should be able to be a fan of this book. Anyone who read this over the summer of 1990 when ABC was rerunning the first 8 episodes, I can't imagine they'd think anyone but Bob was the killer. I think anyone who watched the end of the season 2 premiere saw Ronette Pulaski reliving the murder in the train car would know Bob is the killer. I remember being extremely confused when people still didn't seem to know who the killer was when I saw, and could not unsee if I wanted to, the answer so clearly. I don't understand how people refuse to see, but I was young enough that I didn't distinguish between the Dreamscape characters and the Waking Hours townsfolk. All were part of the same TV show, and realism apparently wasn't really important to me. But I didn't care that I knew who did it. I was there to find out why. And thankfully, at that age, I did not read the diary to delve deeper and confront my fears head on, or I might actually have been genuinely traumatized instead of just playfully traumatized.
Playfully traumatized.
What? That's a new joining of terms. Laura would enjoy playfully traumatizing you. Methinks.
But there'd be sex involved, so just be prepared for that.
Of course. Okay. I know if I'd seen Twin Peaks later in my life, as you did, I'd still be extremely fond of it. I'd recommend it to everyone like I did Patrick McGoohan's 60s masterpiece, The Prisoner, which I've watched 3 times, though. I recognize Twin Peaks for its brilliance, especially for how it was compared to everything else on the air when it was first broadcast, though it wouldn't be nearly as formative. But as it stands, my proverbial therapy couch will always have chevron pattern fabric. It just will.
It's fitting. It should.
Right after my 12th birthday is when Twin Peaks premiered. My mom was on board immediately, and I caught up over the first summer. I watched the Saturday Night Live with Kyle MacLachlan and everything. I was on board, and I enjoyed scaring myself with things as mundane as Bob crouching in the corner of Laura's bedroom and even Leo hiding behind the door with an axe as Bobby came in. That's how young I was. I was not an early bloomer. I might have been a middle bloomer or even late bloomer. In diary terms, when I started watching the show, I was definitely a Donna. Say, sad to say, maybe even a James.
Whoa. Don't do that to yourself, John. Come on. It would be preferable to be an Andy rather than a James, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just being too hard on the guy.
And then that season 2 premiere got real, and my extremely empathetic mind felt that the show at that subliminal level, and Bob basically moved into part of my brain and brought all this stuff with him. There were years when I didn't want to take a shower because I couldn't bring myself to look into the mirror because I didn't want to see Bob looking back at me. I was in high – maybe you are a Jacoby. I was in high school before. I was in high school for a year before I could shake that off completely. You and Steve have this in common because Steve had a similar relationship with Reagan from The Exorcist. He watched this at 12, right? Weren't you 12 years old? And then he used to be outside, and he would look fearfully up at his bedroom window worrying that Reagan was in his room. And it's his favorite movie to this day.
We have to understand why. I watched the movie. If you've ever seen the movie, you know what goes on in the movie. And I had watched it with a friend who was staying the night and my mom. And my mom, being the devout Catholic she is, who believes in possession, believes in demons and all this other stuff. And she turns to me and she says, you know, that can really happen. And it's like, Jesus Christ, what are you telling me, woman? You know, so, I mean, I think I can be forgiven as an impressionable 12-year-old for believing my mother when she tells me that can actually happen. And then wondering like, well, why wouldn't there be a demonic spirit in my bedroom? It was in this little girl's bedroom. She didn't do anything wrong. She didn't even meet him halfway. Think about that.
So John goes on to say, and when I was 17, still essentially a Donna, I'm minding my own business in the middle of summer in a dark room of my childhood home, flipping around until I stop the cable on Bravo and I see the record player skipping. And here I am accidentally confronting this thing I hadn't actually seen since I was 12. And I'm watching that TV girl I had a crush on getting killed again by less frequent but still in my nightmares, Bob. It was pretty cathartic, reliving it from the side of puberty, knowing I hadn't turned into Bob after all. But the surprised 12-year-old brain that surfaced gave me the irrational correction of not yet anyway. But I watched all those episodes I missed, as well as that series finale that equally got to me. And from that point, I started doing all my therapy couch work that I'm apparently still doing some bookkeeping on. This whole time frame from me first watching Twin Peaks to the moment I finally saw every episode is literally the exact time frame of Laura's life from the first page to the last page of her diary. If my real-time TV-style backseat view of the abuse and the violence can leave such an impression on me, I can't even comprehend how a character like Laura could have done anything different than she did in her diary, just to take the weight off her shoulders and cloud her eyes from something more indelible than images alone can produce. I figured out years later that much like Grimm's fairy tales used to scare the hell out of children in hopes of reducing them disobeying their parents, I've come to think Twin Peaks was specifically to me a cautionary tale of exactly what could go wrong after you sexually awaken and go through puberty. I spent years worrying that I could have this power, this evil side within me that could inflict harm on others, whether I want to do so or not, and that I could become this at any moment, no matter what I may do to prevent this. I always thought my issues ran parallel to Laura's, that she was only worried about things as a victim, so reading this book was even more depressing, knowing that she was also worried about Bob taking control over her as well. It's such a heartbreaking book, summed up by this heading from an Amazon review I saw. A lot like Go Ask Alice, but even more sad if that's possible. Jennifer Lynch was amazing with just how deeply into Laura's character she could get, and it makes me sad for her knowing how she considered herself able to get into this character as easily as free writing. Maybe I'm just extremely empathetic, but I would think writing this book was incredibly taxing for her. But just looking at the nuts and bolts of this storytelling, she was great. Particularly her skill at aging Laura's writing as Laura got older herself is something worth shining a light on. The Harry Potter books got progressively more complex as Harry got older, and the diary did the same exact thing with much weightier concepts. At 12, Laura couldn't talk about what she was going through. She just wanted to stay away from bad things. At 13, she was still in pain, but she was trying to take control of things, finding sexuality can control people, and that hurting herself first might just leave other people with nothing left to do and therefore leave her alone. At age 14, she can swear in her diary, and drugs and Bobby enter into the diary, as well as admit what Bob was doing. Really, it took her 2 years to admit in writing that Bob was literally a person in her life instead of essentially an abstract concept. Her 14th year is when she finally admits what happens to her is a reality, and in her 15th year, she realizes everything she's done to change her life from that pain has turned sour and has done exactly what Bob said it would, which essentially leads directly to her downfall. Wow, that was a really great summarizing of that diary.
Yeah, that's it. Kind of just broke it down and like... Yeah. Anybody who's listening to this who hasn't read the diary, you can skip it. You just listen to that.
And then from there, it gets just worse and covers plot points while weaving itself through the threads that make up the show's first season. I like how it does so in an organic way. Instead of saying, oh, now there's this thing in the TV show you like. Isn't it interesting that Laura somehow is in on it? It only shows the events from Laura's point of view and stays consistent with her own narrative and point of view. One way it could have gone for the commercial audience is including more Ben Horn or even Audrey, but they kept the focus right where it should be, and characters, regardless of their popularity, were only included if necessary. I really appreciate that. I also feel that the way Leo was included fleshed out his character into something more than a cardboard thug while still staying consistent with the TV portrayal. And Bobby's treatment in the book really explains why Bobby didn't really love her anyway, even though on some level he still did. I'm curious if anyone knows whether Eric DeRay or Dana Ashbrook read their parts of the diary as they were filming things. I assume DeRay did not, and I suspect that Ashbrook would have heavily benefited from it, but probably didn't know about the book until it was already published. Either way, his performance on the show, especially that scene between Bobby and Jacoby, "Did she laugh at you?" is greatly enriched if you read this first. And if not, the scene in the book is greatly enriched by knowing the scene from the show, because it has a tragedy you know will come off before it even happens in the pages. That scene also shows one of the most important strengths of this book, even though Laura treats Bobby miserably, even though she breaks him down psychologically, you're still rooting for Laura by the end of the entry because of how well she explains her inner struggles at the time. In relation to the TV show, I'm surprised how well the tone matches the show, despite all the swearing. Honestly, aside from the couple of explicit sex scenes and actual swears, there isn't anything else that was left out of the show. In One Eye Jacks, they basically show heroin, and I'm pretty confident that that cover of Flesh World magazine was a dildo, has a dildo on it. I always forget to check on that when I'm watching the show, but I totally believe that the props department was trying to screw with the censors and actually put it in on the show.
That would be great if they did that.
And in relation to Jennifer Lynch being chosen to write this particular book, I understand that she is a creative force and so is her dad, but that has to be only one level this book works on, and then there's their family bond. I wonder if Jennifer Lynch was already in love with Laura's story when he gave this to his own daughter, or if it was Jennifer's work on the story that finalized the unshakable grip Laura has around him. If Jennifer Lynch was 22 when the book was published, she must have been 20 or 21 when she started writing it. David Lynch was right there, literally hearing his own daughter in Laura, and if that isn't a reason to rescue a girl from her sick fate, I don't know what is. Back to the book. I like how the introduction of Harold is handled and how Josie is basically dismissed by Laura as a big worthless faker.
Yes!
Did that make you happy, Steve? He asks.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
And I really appreciate the take on Jacoby, how he's the only person in the whole town who embraces Laura as a whole. Bob wants to wear Laura like a skin, and not even he appreciates every side of Laura's personality. This makes me wish Jacoby was in more of season two than he was in. That could have been fascinating watching Russ Tamblyn, the kind of guy who would dance as easily in the light as the darkness. But the best part of the later sections of the book is that James is only in one entry. As I got closer to the end, I dreaded that James was going to enter the backstory and completely ruin the vibe. So that was one of the only pleasant surprises. I caught myself as it got closer to the end of the book, looking at the book from a book critic point of view instead of an empathetic reader wanting to help the protagonist. I wondered if that crafted into the writing that even maybe Laura herself just can't bear to write about her struggle to be good anymore, and she's now writing about things only when she goes through events like working at One Eye Jacks. I think this is summed up around the part of the book just after she tries being sober for that one August. She can't operate without medicating, and it's a fact of her life she's now resigned to. And I guess so am I. Depressing. That's all I have got time for this time around. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to finally read the diary. See you next time with the Cooper book. Take care, John.
Once again, John is writing from work, as we can see at the bottom of this. And if he's half as productive at his job as he is with his feedback, then he's probably one of the best employees that they have, so they just let it slide.
And thanks for that awesome letter, John.
Once again, this really illustrates why we like listener feedback, because we just get this around the world. Each one of our listeners has their own unique take on the material that we're discussing, and they bring something else to it. And it's kind of like looking at it through different mediums. Some people's feedback makes you look at it like a movie, others like a book, others like a graphic novel, others like a play. So it's great to have everybody's different outlooks on it.
So you guys are all so smart, too. It's such a pleasure.
So the next one up is Tyler. Hello again. All right. I tried and tried to make some good observations about the diary, which I love. Only came up with a couple of comments. Hopefully the other fans are really bringing their A game. Don't worry, Tyler. They're picking up your slack. First, I wanted to say Jennifer Lynch does a really good job at balancing Laura being a typical teen in vocabulary and mindset with her being matured by the darkness of her personal life. I always tell people to read this if they don't like Laura from the show, and so far everyone who has done so liked her much more after seeing her perspective. Hmm. It's easy to watch the show and just think of Laura Palmer as a symbol or trope instead of a real person. That's a good point. Second, I think it's really weird that this was released before the second season since it spoils the ending. Third, my only complaint on the book is that the horse subplot and Bob talking through the diary. It just seemed unnecessary to me. Ah, see, so we have somebody else
who agrees with you.
Who agrees with me. Thank you, Tyler, about that. Yeah. The horse stuff to me wasn't bad. I just felt it ended tragically. It was a really, really explicit way to kind of illustrate an example of the law of unintended consequences. And poor Troy, you know. Ugh. Lastly, I really liked how Bobby was portrayed like an actual decent person in the book before Laura corrupts him. My thoughts on that have been made clear. I completely agree. I think that he was actually humanized a little bit to me. And the next time we watch Twin Peaks all the way through, I'm probably going to like him a lot more than I like a lot of other characters, just because I'm going to have a greater understanding and therefore much more sympathy towards
the way Bobby sympathy.
Is. Yeah. Looking forward to the show. I've never read My Life, My Tapes, so I'm going to buy it on my next paycheck.
Yay!
All right. Regards, Tyler. P.S. I hope Bob doesn't come tonight. We hope so, too. All right, so that's all we've got. That concludes our three-part coverage on The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. We went through that, and then we got to the most important part, which was you guys' feedback on it. And it was pretty... Some of it was... Let me just back up. I'll say that again. And we got to the most important part, which was the listener feedback on that, which is always the best part. And thank you guys for writing in.
Yes. Thanks, guys. And okay. So a month from now, we're going to be doing the My Life, My Tapes. So, you know, if you want to participate, you've got a month to formulate your emails and commentaries, whatnot.
And I understand that some of these books, like I don't know how many of you had original copies of The Secret Diary, but some of these books are a little bit pricey, if I'm not mistaken. They're kind of collector's editions. I mean, you're not going to have to pay hundreds of dollars for them or whatever, but if you have a Kindle or a device similar to that, I'm pretty sure you can download it for super cheap.
And you can read My Life, My Tapes for free online. I've seen it online.
Oh, good. Even better. Thing, yeah. Even better. That's mm-hmm. awesome. Make it accessible to everybody because... We've got original copies of both, but I did a search. It was a couple of months ago just to see how much they cost to see if I could get another one so we could read it at the same time before you suggested the Kindle. And it was decently priced.
Which one?
I think Laura Palmer's Diary.
And I wrote all in that one.
I want to say My Life, My Tapes was also kind of steep too.
Yeah, but I was okay with writing in it because it's – this podcast is a milestone in our lives, so writing in that diary, I think it's kind of cool for
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I thought so, too. I mean, you know, when you go back to it years and years from now and you look at it, and you'll just be like, remember when we did the notes for that? Mm-hmm.
Yep, because I don't plan on ever getting rid of it. So
yeah, exactly.
All right, well, that's it. So we will talk at you in a month. I'm your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.